He doesn't add, and call me Fred, so I won't. I press record and speak into the microphone. Interview with Fred Pink at the Fox and Hounds pub, Saturday, 28th October, 2006, 7:20 p.m. I swivel the recorder so the mic's facing him. Ready when you are. The old man takes a deep breath.
Well, first thing to say is, once you've been a psychiatric patient, no one ever gives you the benefit of the doubt again. Easier to fix a bad credit rating than a bad credibility rating.
Fred Pink speaks with care, as if he's writing his words in permanent ink.
But whether you believe me or not, Miss Timms, I'm guilty. Guilty. See, I'm the one who told my nephew Alan about Slade Alley, about Gordon Edmonds, about Nathan and Rita Bishop, about the 9-year cycle. It was me who whetted Alan's appetite. Alan had told me there was 20 or 30 of them in his club, so I reckoned safety in numbers. Atemporals, fear, exposure, see? 6 kids vanishing was big news for sure, but 20 or 30, they'd never dare. All sorts would have come running. MI7, FBI if any Americans were involved, my friend David Icke, the old blooming shebang would be all over Slade House like a dose of the clap. If I'd known Alan's group was down to 6, I'd have told him. Too risky, just forget it. And if I'd done that, my nephew and your sister and Lance Matthews, Todd Cosgrove, Angelica Gibbons and Fern Penhaligon, they'd still be here, living their lives. With jobs, boyfriends, girlfriends, mortgages. Knowing that's a torment, Miss Timms. A never-ending torment.
Fred Pink swallows, clenches his jaw and shuts his eyes. I write atemporal and David Icke in my notebook to give him time to compose himself.
Sorry, Miss Timms, I've got regrets about Sally too, I assure him. But I think you're being too hard on yourself.
Fred Pink dabs his eyes with an old tissue and sips his bitter. He stares at the Guinness-drinking leprechaun. In your email, you mentioned a backstory, Mr. Pink, I prompt.
I did. The backstory's why I asked to meet you here this evening. If we did this on the phone, you'd hang up. Even face-to-face in places, you'll think, ruddy Nora, the mad old Rex lost the plot. But hear me out. It leads to Sally.
I'm a journalist. I know reality's complex. I remember Avril using those very words, a mad old wreck, when she read Fred Pink's first email a couple of weeks ago. But I tell the old man, I'm listening.
We'll kick off over a century ago then, near Ely in Norfolk, at a stately home called Swaffham Manor. Nowadays, a Saudi Arabian pal of Prince Charles owns the place, but back then it was the ancestral seat of a family called the Chetwynd Pitts, who you'll find in the Doomsday Book, if you please. In 1899, twins was born at Swaffham, a girl and a boy. Not in the big house, mind, but in the gamekeeper's cottage on the edge of the estate. The father was Gabriel Grayer. The mother was his wife, Nellie Grayer, and the twins was named Nora and Jonah. They never got to know their father that well, because Gabriel Grayer got shot 3 years later by a toff who mistook his peasants for his pheasants, so to speak. Lord and Lady Chetwynd Pitt felt guilty about the accident, so they let Nellie Grayer and the children stay on in the gamekeeper's cottage. More than that, they took care of Nora and Jonah's schooling, and when Nellie Grayer died of rheumatic fever in 1910, the twin orphans moved into Swaffham Manor proper.
You've done a lot of research, I tell Fred Pink.
It's my hobby, like. Well, my life, really. You should see my flat. It's all papers and files everywhere. Now, you'll have heard stories about the empathy between twins, I'm guessing. You know, where one twin gets hit by a bus in Istanbul, say, and the other falls over in London at the exact same moment. But did you know that twins will sometimes speak a language that only they understand, especially when they're still learning to talk? As a matter of fact, yes. When I lived in Manhattan, I used to babysit for toddler triplets who talked in their own private dialect. It was amazing to hear. Well, events took place at Swaffham Manor, what suggested Nora and Jonah Greyer combined these two skills. To call a spade, telepathy. Fred Pink gives me a probing look. Do we have a problem with telepathy, Miss Timms? My nutter detector glows amber. I am rather a fan of proof, Mr. Pink. So am I. So am I. Albertina Chetwynd Pitt, her ladyship, published a memoir in 1925 called Rivers, Old and Lost. It's all about what I'm telling you now. The twins, their upbringing and everything. In it she says how one January evening in 1910, she, her daughters and Nora Greyer were all playing cribbage in the drawing room at Swaffham. All of a sudden, Nora cried out, dropped her cards, and said that Arthur, the eldest Chetwynd Pitt boy, had fallen off his horse at Pool's Brook, over a mile away from the manor, and couldn't move. He needed a stretcher, and the doctor, right away. Lady Albertina was shocked that Nora'd tell such a baseless fib, but Nora begged her to send help, cause, and I quote, Jonah is with him, and Jonah is telling me. By now, the Chetwynd Pitt daughters were properly spooked too. So, against her better judgment, Lady Albertina sent a servant running off, who found the scene as Nora described it, in every detail. I reach for my tomato juice, but it still looks like roadkill, and I change my mind. It's a tasty anecdote, but how is it proof? Fred Pink takes out his Benson and Hedges, remembers the smoking ban, and puts the cigarettes back, tetchily. The day after, the twins were interviewed by Lord and Lady Chetwynd Pitt with their friend, Dean Grimond, of Ely Cathedral. Dean Grimond was a no-nonsense, hard-boiled Scot who'd been an army chaplain in the Crimea and had none of the airy-fairy about him. He ordered the twins to tell him how Nora'd known about Arthur coming off his horse at Pool's Brook. So the twins confessed they'd been able to telegram thoughts for years, but kept it a secret, cause they'd noticed it scared people and drew attention to them. Like you, Miss Timms, Lord Chetwynd Pitt wanted proof, so he devised this experiment. He gave Nora a pencil and paper, led Jonah to the billiards room in Swaffham Manor, and read out a random line from the Jungle Book. His lordship then asked Jonah to telegram the line to Nora, back in the library. Jonah shut his eyes for a few seconds, then said the job was done. They both went back to the library to find that Nora had written down the very same line from Kipling. Fred Pink looks at me as if the matter is now beyond dispute. I say, remarkable, but think, if all this actually took place. Next, Dean Grimond got Nora to telegram a verse from St. John's Gospel. Fred Pink shuts his eyes. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. Back in the billiards room, Jonah wrote it down, word perfect. Lastly, Lady Albertina wanted a turn. She had Jonah telegram a verse from a nursery rhyme in German. Nora wrote it, word perfect, though with a few spelling mistakes. Neither of the twins knew a word of German, see? Fred Pink slurps his bitter and dabs his cracked lips with the frayed sleeve of his jacket. The upshot? Dean Grimond told the twins that some of God's gifts are better left unexamined, and that they shouldn't refer to their telegrams in public lest excitable persons be tempted down wrong paths. Nora and Jonah promised to obey. Dean Grimmon gave them both a humbug and went back to his cathedral. Nice work if you can get it. A TV roar of disappointment wafts up the stairs. Checking my Sony's still working, I ask, how do you know Lady Albertina is a trustworthy source? Fred Pink rubs his scalp and dandruff falls.
Same way you judge your sources, I imagine, Miss Timms. By developing a nose for a lie, an ear for a fib, and an eye for a tell. Right? Lady Chetwynd Pitt's book is detailed, where a fraud would gloss over stuff, and rough, where a liar would polish it better. Anyway, where's her motive for lying? Not money. She was loaded. Not attention. She only had 100 copies of her book printed, and by the time it was published, she was a virtual recluse-like.
I swivel my gold ring from Avril round my finger. In journalism, we try to cross-corroborate an informant's more contentious claims.
Cross-corroborate. Good word. I'll store that away.
It's time you met Dr. Léon Cantillon.
Fred Pink unfastens his satchel, takes out a dog-eared folder, and produces a laser-scanned copy of an old hand-tinted photograph of a man of about 40. He's wearing a French Foreign Legion uniform, a raffish smile, a couple of medals, and round his neck, a stethoscope. The caption underneath reads, Le Docteur Léon Cantillon, Légion étrangère, Ordre national de la Légion d'honneur, Croix de guerre.
Léon Cantillon. Colourful figure, you might say. Born in 1874 in Dublin, in an old French Huguenot family. Grew up speaking French. Studied medicine at Trinity College, but he had a hot-headed streak and had to leave Ireland after shooting the son of a Member of Parliament in a duel, no less. Bang! Straight between the eyes. Dead before he hit the deck. Cantillon joined the French Foreign Legion a few months later. We're up to 1895 now, and served as a medic in the Mandingo War on the Ivory Coast, and later in the South Oranese Campaign. Dirty little wars in the carve-up of Africa, these. Even the French have forgotten them nowadays. Cantillon had a knack for languages, too. When he wasn't doctoring and soldiering, he was learning Arabic, and claims he spoke it fluently by 1905, when he got himself a plum job at the Legion's hospital in Algiers. It was in Algiers that his interest in the occult took root by his own account. He mingled with Prussian theosophists, Armenian spiritualists, Ibadi Muslim shamans, Hasidic Kabbalists, and one mystic in particular who lived south of Algiers, in the foothills of the Atlas Mountains. He's known as the albino Saeed of Ait Arif, and by he'd be playing a major role in the Greyers' lives.
This is all sounding a bit Da Vinci Code for me. What's your source for all of this, Mr. Pink? Lady Albertina's book?
No. Léon Cantillon wrote his memoir too, see? The Great Unveiling. My own copy's one of just 10 known survivors, and it's this account what cross-corroborates Lady Albertina's story, so to speak.
He turns away to cough a smoker's cough into the crook of his elbow. It lasts a good while.
So, Dr. Cantillon met Lord Chetwynd Pitt in early summer of 1915 at the House of Mutual Friends in London. After a few schooners of port, his lordship began telling the soldier doctor about Lady Albertina's chronic hysteria. The poor woman was in a terrible state by this point. In March of 1915, all three of Lord and Lady Chetwynd Pitt's sons had been gassed, blown up, or machine-gunned in the very same week at the Battle of Neuve-Chapelle. All three. Imagine that. On Monday, you got three sons. By Friday,
You've got none. Lady Albertina had just, you know, caved in. Physically, mentally, spiritually, brutally. Her husband hoped that Léon Cantillon, as a sympathetic spiritualist and a man of medicine, might be the man to help where everyone else had failed, like, to bring her back from the brink.
Fred Pink's framed by the window. Dusk's falling. So the Chetwynd Pitts had been dabbling in spiritualism since the telegram incident, had they?
They had, Miss Timms, they had. The craze for seances was in full swing, see? And the likes of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, no less, were saying it was founded in science. To be sure, there was no shortage of shysters, all too happy to milk the craze. But thanks to Nora and Jonah, the Chetwynd Pitts knew that some psychic phenomena, at least, was genuine. As a matter of fact, Lord Chetwynd Pitt had brought several mediums up to Ely to channel the spirits of their dead boys, but none of them had proved themselves to be the real McCoy. And with each dashed hope, Lady Albertina's sanity took a fresh battering.
I bring the tomato juice to my lips, but it still looks like a specimen jar in a blood bank. And could Dr. Cantillon help? Fred Pink rubs his wiry bristles.
Well, after a fashion, yes, though he never claimed to be a medium. After examining Lady Albertina, Cantillon said that her grief had severed her ethereal cord to her spirit guide. He performed a healing ritual he'd learned off of a shaman in the mountains of Rith and prescribed an elixir.
In her book, Lady Albertina wrote that the elixir gave her a vision of an angel rolling away a stone from her entombment, and she saw her three sons happy on a higher plane. In his book, Cantillon mentions that his elixir contained a new wonder drug called cocaine.
So make of that what you will. I'd add to the mix the benefits of the talking cure as well. The chance for an Edwardian lady to spill her guts in private and vent her spleen at God, King and country must have been therapeutic to say the least. Like grief counselling nowadays. Certainly at this stage in the proceedings, Dr. Cantillon seems to have been a very welcome guest indeed.
My phone buzzes in my bag. Avril texting me back, I expect, but I ignore it. Where are the Greyer twins in all this?
Right. Jonah was an apprentice clerk in the Swaffham Manor estate office. Short-sightedness and a dicky ticker had saved him from the trenches, though as these conditions never troubled him in later life, I can't help but wonder how real they were. Nora was a weekly boarder at a school for ladies in Cambridge to up her marriage prospects. Léon Cantillon had heard about their telegrams from the Chetwynd Pitts, of course, so the first chance he had, he asked for a demo. It took place on the doctor's first weekend at Swaffham. He was impressed. He was very impressed. An annunciation of the new age of man, he later called it. A fortnight later, Cantillon put a proposal to his hosts. If they lent him Nora and Jonah, and if the twins was willing, he'd provide a psychic education consummate with their gifts. The doctor said he knew an occultic teacher who'd train the twins in spirit channeling. Once Nora and Joan had mastered that skill, he said, Lady Albertina'd be able to freely speak with her sons from their higher plane without fear of being gulled by swindlers.
I sniff a swindler. How for real was Dr. Cantillon? The old man rubs a watery blue, red-rimmed eye and growls thoughtfully.
Well, the Chetwynd Pitts believed him, which is what matters to our backstory. They agreed to his proposal to educate Nora and Jonah, but here's where the doctor's version of events and Lady Albertina's begin to part ways. She wrote that Léon Cantillon had promised the twins would be away no more than a few months. Cantillon's claim is that the Chetwynd Pitts gave him guardianship of the Greyers with no small print about expiry dates, time or distance. Who's telling the truth? That I can't tell you. Truth has this habit of changing after the fact, don't you find? What we do know is that Léon Cantillon took the twins first to Dover, crossed over to Calais, passed through wartime Paris, carried on south to Marseille, then sailed by steamship to Algiers. Lady Albertina calls this journey an abduction, no more, no less. But by the time she and her husband found out about it, the horse had bolted. Repatriation of minors is tricky enough now. Back then, when 16-year-olds were adults in most senses, and with the Great War in top gear, so to speak, and inside French colonial jurisprudence, forget it. The Greyer twins were gone.
I'm not clear. Were they taken against their will? Fred Pink's face says, hardly likely.
Which would you choose? Life as an orphan pleb in the Tory Fens in wartime England, or life as a student of the occult under the Algerian stars?
It would depend on whether I believed in the occult.
They believed.
Fred Pink sips his bitter.
Sally did too.
And if she hadn't, I think, she wouldn't have been playing Ghostbusters in unfamiliar backstreets at night, and whatever happened to her wouldn't have happened. Either I bite my tongue or I kill the interview. The Greyers stayed in Algeria then?
They did, yes. Nora and Jonah already knew telepathy. What other powers might they acquire in the right hands? Léon Cantillon was a sly operator, there's no doubt, but a sly operator can still be the right man for the job.
He looks at Léon Cantillon's photo again.
He took the twins to the albino Saïd of Aïd Arif. I mentioned him before. The Saïd followed an occult branch called La Voie Ombragée, or the Shaded Way, and lived in a dwelling of many rooms by a fast-flowing stream at a high neck of a secret valley, a day's ride from Algiers. And that's about all the info Cantillon gives us. The Saïd accepted the odd foreign twins, who couldn't speak a word of Arabic at this point, remember, as disciples in his house, so he must have seen potential in them. Cantillon returned to his duties at the Foreign Legion Hospital in Algiers, though he made the journey to the Saïd's once a fortnight to check up on his young charge's progress.
Outside the pub, a woman hollers, "You're supposed to indicate, moron!" And a car roars off. "Mr. Pink," I say, "if I can be frank, this story feels a long way away from my sister's disappearance." Fred Pink nods and frowns at the clock on the wall. 8:14.
Give me till 9 o'clock. If I haven't connected all of this with your Sally and my Alan by then, I'll call you a taxi. On my honour.
While I don't have Fred Pink marked down as a liar, I do have him marked down as a dreamer upper of alternative histories. On the other hand, after all these years, my own inquiries into Sally's disappearance have led exactly nowhere. Maybe Fred Pink's tracking me down is a hint that I need to look for leads in less obvious places. Starting now.
Okay, 9 o'clock.
Was channeling dead spirits on the Saïd syllabus, as Cantillon had promised Lady Albertina?
You've got a knack of asking the right question, Miss Timms.
Fred Pink gets out a box of spearmint Tic Tacs, shakes out three, offers me one. I refuse, and puts all three in his mouth.
No, Léon Cantillon had lied to the Chetwynd Pitts about seances. I think he knew perfectly well that seances are almost always fraud. When you die, your soul crosses the dusk between life and the blank sea. The journey takes 49 days, but there's no Wi-Fi there, so to speak, so no messages can be sent.
either way. Mediums might convince themselves they're hearing voices from the dead, but the boring reality is it's impossible.
Well, that's wacko.
That's very exact. 49 days.
Fred Pink shrugs.
Speed of sound's very exact. So's pi. So are chemical formulas.
He crunches his tic-tacs.
Ever been to the Atlas Mountains in North Africa, Miss Timms?
I shake my head.
I have, believe it or not, just a few years back, thanks to 3,000 quid I won on a scratch card. Goes a blooming long way in Algeria, does £3,000, if you watch out for the pickpockets and rip-off merchants. Those buckled-up mountains, the dry sky, the hot wind, the whole massive otherness of it, so to speak. I'll never forget it. Rewires your head if you stay there too long. Little wonder all the hippies and that lot made a beeline for places like Marrakesh in the 60s. Places change you, Miss Timms, and deserts change us, pale northerners, so much. Our own mothers wouldn't recognize us. Day by day, the twins' Englishness ebbed away. They picked up Arabic from the Said's other disciples. They ate flatbread, hummus and figs. Jonah let his beard grow. Nora wore a veil like a good Muslim girl. And sandals and dish dashers made more sense in that climate than shoes and cufflinks and petticoats and what have you. The calendar lost its meaning for the twins, Contillon writes. 1, 2, 3 years passed. They learned occult arts and obscure sciences that there aren't even words for in English. Things that not one mind in 100,000 learns or could learn, even if the chance came along. De Greyer's only link with the outside world was Dr. Contillon. But when he brought them up to speed with that world, the slaughter in Flanders, the fallout from Gallipoli, the killings in Mesopotamia, the politics in Westminster, in Berlin, in Paris, in Washington. To Nora and Jonah, it all sounded like stuff going on in places they'd read about years ago. Not real. For the twins, home was their Said's Valley. Their fatherland and motherland was the Shaded Way.
Fred Pink scratches his itchy neck. He appears to suffer from mild psoriasis, and stares through my head all the way to a moonlit dwelling in the Atlas Mountains. The cracked clock says 8:18. How long were they there?
Until April 1919. It ended as suddenly as it begun, like. Contillon visited the Said one day, and the master told him he'd taught the twins all the knowledge he could impart. The time had come for the great globe itself to be their master, he said. Which meant what, exactly? And where? England held no great attraction for any of them. There'd be no fond welcome home from the Chetwynd pits at Swaffham Manor, that was for sure. Ireland was having birth pangs and gearing up for a vicious civil war. France was on its knees, along with most of Europe. Algiers' boom years as a war port were over, and Léon Contillon, who was always better at spending money than earning it, now found himself with a pair of oddball, semi-Arabized English twins in tow. How to convert the Greyer's occultic knowledge into a well-padded lifestyle? That was the doctor's dilemma, wasn't it? And the answer? The good old US of A. That was the answer. The three of them sailed for New York in July, second class, with Contillon posing as the twins' Uncle Léon. Nora and Jonah were hungry to see the world, like gap year kids nowadays. They took a townhouse on Clinker Street in Greenwich Village.
I know it well, I say. Spyglass's New York office is on Clinker Street.
Is that a fact?
Fred Pink sips his bitter and suppresses a belch.
Excuse me. Small world.
What do they do to earn a living in the States? Fred Pink gives me a knowing look.
They held seances.
But seances are fraudulent, you just said.
I did. They are. And I'm not here to defend Cantillon or the twins, Miss Timms, but they weren't hucksters in the usual manner. See, Nora and Jonah could read minds, or overhear the thoughts of most people they came across. That bit wasn't a trick. It was just an extra sense they had, like extremely sensitive hearing. They could rummage through their clients' minds and discover things no one knew, not even the people whose minds they were in. The twins knew what their grief-stricken clients most needed to hear and what words had best heal them. And those were the words they said. The only fiction was the claim that these words came from the dear departed. Now, you might say that's worse, not better, and maybe you'd be right. But is it so far away from what your shrinks and counsellors and psycho-whatnots try to do nowadays? There was a lot, and I do mean a lot, of unhappy and despairing and downright suicidal New Yorkers who left that little house on Clinker Street, certain, quite certain, that their loved ones were in a better place and looking out for them, and that one day they'd be reunited. I mean, that's what religion does, doesn't it? Are you going to condemn every priest and imam and rabbi on earth for doing the very same thing? No. The Greyer twin seances weren't real, but yes, the hope they gave was. Isn't the yes better than the no?
Fraud's fraud, I think, but I perform an ambiguous nod. So the New York gigs went well.
Very. Cantillon was a canny manager. Once the Greyers got a bit of a name for themselves, he switched tack. Discreet appointments at wealthy clients' homes. No props, no smoke, no mirrors, no ectoplasm, no Ouija, no daft voices. No public performances, nothing vulgar or theatrical. Just quiet, calm, sane grief relief, so to speak. Your son says this, and your sister says that. If Cantillon felt a possible client was only a thrill-seeker, he turned them down. Or so he claimed, anyway.
A football chant from the TV below wafts upstairs. It's a choppy, lulling and otherworldly sound. If the Greyers had an array of genuine psychic powers, why content themselves with telling consoling fibs to rich Americans? Fred Pink shrugs like a comedy Frenchman, palms raised, shoulders high and head low.
Cantillon's motives, I'll guess at, money. But Nora and Jonah left no written account, so who's to say? Maybe they saw themselves as students of humanity, and seances let them study people better. They had a serious case of wanderlust, too. And their seance service, let's call it, was a passport valid in all territories. Personal recommendations smoothed their way, and Uncle Leon and his niece and nephew never travelled second class again. In the spring of 1920, they moved to Boston. In autumn, it was Charleston, then New Orleans, then San Francisco. Why stop there? They took a liner to Hawaii, then to Yokohama. After a spell in Japan, they travelled on to Peking, Manchuria, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Macau, Ceylon. The best hotels and the houses of the grateful rich were their homes in that period. Bombay, New Delhi, a year or two in the British Raj, why not? A summer up in the hill stations. Then Aden, Suez, Cairo, Cyprus, Constantinople, Athens. A winter in Rome, a spring in Vienna, a summer in Berlin, Christmas in Paris. In his book, Cantillon describes how the twins honed their arts as they travelled, seeing the sights, and settled for a brief sojourn, like exotic birds, in whatever society they found themselves in. Nora rejected no less than 6
proposals of marriage, and no doubt Jonah enjoyed his share of liaisons and conquests, but always they carried on westwards, till one drizzly day in May 1925, the Dover train trundled into Victoria Station, and the Greyers and their guardian took a cab to a house in Queen's Gardens, a swish and leafy street in Bayswater. They financed 5 years of luxury globetrotting with seances. They diversified a bit once they left the States. Disciples of the Shaded Way learned the art of suasion. A tackier name is mind control. Maybe you can guess, Miss Timms, how a talent like that might be turned into a few bob. I play along. If suasioning were real, you could enlist a nearby millionaire to make you out a humongous bank draft. Fred Pink's face suggests I guessed correctly.
And after, you use another Shaded Way skill, redaction, to erase your generous benefactor's memory of ever writing the check. Some would call it the perfect crime. Others would call it survival. A socialist would call it the redistribution of wealth.
Fred Pink stands up.
Might I just pop to the gents, Miss Timms? The beer was a mistake. My prostate's not what it was.
I indicate the doorway. I'm not going anywhere. Yet.
Aren't you drinking your tomato juice, Miss Timms?
I look at it.
I just don't really fancy it, after all. I'll bring you something else up. Listening's thirsty work.
I wave him away. No need, really. Fred Pink makes a mock glum face.
Oh, but I insist.
A bit later. When he's gone, I turn off my digital recorder. It's all saved. Not that I'll ever listen to it again. Only an all-out conspiracy theorist or the mentally ill would connect this Norfolk, Dublin, Algeria, America, Trans-Pacific, mysterious Orient tale with six students who went missing in 1997. It's tempting just to slip away now, while there are still lots of trains back to London. Really, what could Fred Pink do if I did a runner now? Send me a pissed-off email? I'm a journalist. I get 20 pissed-off emails per hour. Fred Pink spent 9 years of his life in a coma, more years locked away in a secure ward beyond Slough's outer reaches, and he's an obvious believer in the dark arts. The man's brain is scrambled. But no, I gave him my word to stay until 9 o'clock, so I'll stay. It's now 8:27. The last text was from Avril, as I thought. Oh, de glamour! But seriously hope Mr. P isn't waste of time. Text me if you need urgent emergency to escape to. I reply. Jury's still out, re Mr. P, but we'll probably get train about 9:30, back to Padders 10, home by 11, I hope. Kiss, kiss, kiss. Send. I don't remember eating dinner, so I suppose I must have missed it. I go downstairs to the bar to see if there's anything to eat. The place looks like a stage set, and rather a cash-strapped one at that. With the departure of the blind chap and his dog, the population of the Fox and Hounds has dwindled to 4. Up on the plasma screen, a red team are playing a blue team, but I don't know who is who. Avril knows that MUN means Manchester United and ARS stands for Arsenal, but I can never work the names out. It's a corner, and the landlady waits a few seconds to watch the outcome. No goal, before dragging herself over to my end of the bar. I ask if she sells snacks, and she lets a long pause elapse to illustrate her contempt for metropolitan media dykes. Cheese and onion crisps already salted, dry roasted peanuts or honey glazed cashews, that's it. Wow, an embarrassment of riches. 2 bags of cashews and a diet tonic water with lemon, please. We only sell real tonic water, not diet. It looks like I'll have a real tonic water then. Thank you so much. The landlady plucks the nuts from a rack, takes the tonic water from a shelf below, flips off the cap, retrieves a glass, drops in a limp segment of lemon, and pecks at the till with her bony index finger.
£3.45.
I hand over the right money. She asks,
What paper do you write for, then?
Spyglass. It's a magazine.
Never heard of it.
It's bigger in the States than it is here.
Like Private Eye, is it? One of those sarcastic papers?
No, not really, I say. It's less satirical.
So why do Americans give two hoots about six students who disappeared in a small English city 9 years ago?
I'm not sure if they do. My editor will decide that. But I'm curious. I consider telling the landlady about Sally, but I don't. Being curious is my job.
It's ancient history, all that stuff is.
She glances at the gents and leans close enough for me to see the evidence of an exhausting life beneath her coating of makeup.
You're not doing Fred any favours by egging him on. He blames himself for Alan's vanishing, which really is mental.
He spent 6 years at Dawkins Hospital,
locked up with the Teletubbies. You do know that, yeah?
Mr. Pink's been open about his medical history, yes? The landlady's jaw chews phantom gum.
Meanwhile, he fancies himself as this Inspector Morse who'll solve the big mystery and maybe find Alan and the X-Files 6 alive somewhere, which is double mental. X-Files 6. As if it's all some stupid TV show. But it's not. It's serious. It's pain. It's best left buried.
Fred's wife left him in the end. Saint of a woman was Jackie. But when Fred buggered off to Algeria, even she couldn't take it anymore and moved back to the Isle of Man.
Now, all Fred ever thinks about are his theories about his Illuminati, the Holy Grail, Atlantis, and whatever the bollocks it is this week. And you...
She folds her meaty arms as Fred Pink emerges from the gents in the corner.
You're feeding all that, pouring fuel on the flames. Hey, Fred.
She straightens up and smiles at Fred Pink like nothing's wrong.
Your new best friend here was telling me how low some media scum suckers will stoop just to get a story. Throw 'em to the bloody piranhas, I say. Let like eat like.
Fancy a brandy this time, eh?
Sorry about Mags,
says Fred Pink, back in the upstairs room.
I shouldn't have told her you're a journalist.
The locals would rather forget the X-Files 6. Too Amityville horror. Too Bermuda Triangle. Bad for house prices. I munch a handful of honey-glazed cashews. God, they're good. Scumsucker is one of the sweeter names I've been called, believe me.
So, Mr. Pink, we left Dr. Cantillon and the Greyer twins in Bayswater after their years of travel in foreign parts.
Fred Pink sloshes his brandy around the glass.
Yes, it's now 1925. Nora and Jonah are 26, and Uncle Leon is 50. For 10 years he's been their fixer, guardian, PR man, accountant. Now he wants to be their biographer. Or more, their John the Baptist. You see, he decided the time had come to go public and persuade the world that spiritualism and science could be respectably married. Money and a comfortable life wasn't enough, you see. His new ambition was to establish a new discipline, psychosoterica, with none other than Dr. Léon Cantillon as its Darwin, its Freud, its Newton. Which put him at serious odds with Nora and Jonah. See, they'd drunk their fill of the big bad world by this stage. What they wanted was to hide away and see which dead ends down the shaded way might not be dead ends after all. So they told Cantillon no, there'd be no biography. No great unveiling, and no more public engagements. Obedient Uncle Leon told the twins, I hear and obey. But obedient Uncle Leon was lying through his teeth. He spent most of the next 2 years writing his big masterpiece, The Great Unveiling. It wasn't the usual rehash of Europe's top 10 witches and wizards, like most books about the occult were in those days. Léon Cantillon's book had 3 sections. Part 1 was the first ever written history of the Shaded Way, from its 5th century beginnings to the 20th. Part 2 was a biography of the Greyer twins from their Swaffham Manor days to their return to England. Part 3 was a manifesto for an international psychosoterica society to be set up in London with Dr. Guess Who as its lifetime president. My phone buzzes in my bag. Avril's reply to my reply, I bet. It's 8:45. It'll wait. Why did Cantillon go against the twins' wishes? Can't be sure. I suspect he reckoned that once the cat was out of the bag, once Uncle Tom Cobley and all were clamoring for the age of psychosoterica to begin, the Greyers would see how right he was after all and sign up. If that was Cantillon's thinking. Fred Pink ruffles more dandruff out of his hair. He was mistaken. Tragically mistaken. On March 29th, 1927, the printers delivered 10 boxes of The Great Unveiling. On March 30th, the good doctor mailed about 6 dozen copies to various theosophists, philosophers, occultists, and patrons in England and overseas. My copy of the book, which I keep in a safety deposit box in a place I tell nobody, is one of those 6 dozen. In the early hours of the next morning, March 31st, a conveniently positioned Bobby was walking down Queen's Gardens. He saw Léon Cantillon lift his 5th-floor sash window and perch on the sill, naked as a baby, and shout out these words. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. John Milton, if you're curious. Then he jumped. He might have survived, but he landed on a row of pointy railings. You can picture the scene. Quite the 9-day wonder it was. The coroner recorded a verdict of death by insanity, and the Westminster Gazette covered the funeral. Jonah read the eulogy, while Nora, the very model of demure grief, in an ankle-length dress of black crepe, yes, I memorized it, sobbed for her guardian. Jonah told the reporter how he prayed that Dr. Cantillon's bizarre delusions would show how dangerous it can be to meddle in the black arts. Dean Grimmond would have been proud. Weeks passed. The tragedy of the ex-Foreign Legion doctor became old news, and copy by copy, the large stock of unposted great unveilings burned in the Greyer's fireplace in Queen's Gardens. I'm bothered by a phrase. A conveniently positioned Bobby. Fred Pink sips his brandy. Never cross a qualified suasioner. To follow Fred Pink's trail of breadcrumbs, you have to blindfold your own sanity. Meaning a suasioner can also make a man jump to his death?
Exactly so, Miss Timms.
But Cantillon, in your narrative, had been a loyal friend and protector.
Had been, yes. But then he became a threat, a kind of apostate too. The occult's like any religious order, or any bunch of extremists come to that. It's all beer and sunshine and we are your family as long as you obey orders. But once you get your own ideas or start talking out of school, the knives come out. Whether Cantillon was pushed or whether Cantillon jumped, the Greyer's trail grows faint after the Westminster Gazette and stays faint for 4 years. They left the Bayswater House in May 1927. I date their departure from their launderer's accounts. But then, it's a big blank. I found a possible sighting of the twins at Sainte Agnes in the Maritime Alps in 1928,
a reference to mind-reading English twins in Rhodesia in 1929, and a Miss Nora with a twin brother in a love letter sent from Fiji in 1930. But nothing's, what's the word, cross-corroborated. Fred Pink drums his fingers on his bulging satchel. You've already been patient, so I'll hurry us on to your sister's role before the clock strikes 9. I will need to get going then, Mr. Pink. In August 1931, according to the local land register, Mr. Jonah Grayer and his sister, Miss Nora Grayer, bought Slade House, a property not 200 yards from this very pub. It had been an 18th century rectory, attached to the parish of St. Brianna. Once upon a time, it was surrounded by woods and fields, though by the time the Grayers moved in, Slade House was a walled fortress in a sea of brick houses, in a factory town more passed through than stopped at, so to speak. The neighborhood was full of factory workers, full of big families, full of Irish and itinerants, full of folk coming and going and doing midnight flits, which suited the Grayers' purposes down to a T. What purposes were these, Mr. Pink? They needed laboratory rats, see? What I see is the wacometer needle climbing. Laboratory rats for what kind of experiments? Fred Pink's glasses reflect and bend the grimy strip light. I'll die one of these mornings. I'm 79 now. I still smoke like a flaming chimney. My blood pressure's chronic. Max, the landlady, will die too. Whoever keeps sending you them texts will die. And you'll die as well, Miss Timms. Death's life's only guarantee, yes? We all know it, yet we're hardwired to dread it. That dread's our survival instinct, and it serves us well enough when we're young. But it's a curse when you're older. I'm sure you're right, Mr. Pink. And? Nora and Jonah Grayer wanted to not die. Ever. Bang on cue, a goal scored on the TV downstairs, and the crowd surges and roars like a kettle boiling. I maintain my professional face. Don't we all? Yes, we do. Life everlasting. Fred Pink takes off his glasses to rub them on his stained shirt. It's why religion got invented, and it's why religion stays invented. What else matters more than not dying? Power? Gold? Sex? £1 million? £1 billion? £1 trillion? Really? They won't buy you an extra minute when your number's up. No, cheating death. Cheating aging. Cheating the care home. Cheating the mirror. And the dug-up corpse's face like mine that you'll see in your mirror too, Miss Timms. And sooner than you think, that's a prize worth the hunting, the taking. That's the only prize worth hunting. And what we want, we dream of. The stage props change down the ages, but the dream stays the same. Philosopher's stones, magic fountains in lost Tibetan valleys, lichens that slow the decay of our cells, tanks of liquid whatever that'll freeze us for a few centuries, computers that will store our personalities as ones and zeros for the rest of time. To call a spade, immortality. The wacometer needle is stuck on 11. I see. Fred Pink's smile curves downwards. The one little snag being, immortality's all hooey. Right? I sip my non-diet tonic water. Since you ask, yes. He puts his glasses on. What if, very occasionally, it's real? And so, at 8:52, Fred Pink proves himself divorced not only from his wife, but from reality itself. If anyone discovered how not to die, I don't think it'd stay a secret very long. Now he acts as if he's the one humouring me.
Don't you now? Why's that then, Miss Timms?
I strangle a sigh of exasperation. Because the inventors or researchers would want recognition, fame, Nobel Prizes.
No, what they want is not to die, which wouldn't happen by going public. Think about it, about the squalid, shitty reasons that people murder each other in large numbers now. Oil, the drug trade, control over occupied territories, and the word occupied. Water, God's true name, his true will, who owns access to him. The astonishing belief that Iraq can be turned into Sweden by deposing its dictator and smashing the place up a bit. What wouldn't these same warlords, oligarchs, elites and electorates do to enforce their claims over a limited supply of life everlasting? Miss Timms, they'd kick off World War III. Our plucky inventors would be shot by maniacs, be buried in bunkers or die in a nuclear war. If the supply's not limited, the prospects are even bleaker. Yes, we'd all stop dying, but we wouldn't stop breeding, would we? Men are dogs, Miss Timms. You know that. Give it 20, 30, 50 years, there'd be 30, 40, 100 billion human beings eating up our godforsaken world. We'd be drowning in our own shit, even as we fought each other for the last pot noodle in the last supermarket. See? Either way, you lose. If you're smart enough to discover immortality, you're smart enough to ensure your own supply and keep very, very, very stumm indeed. Like the Greyer twins did, in an attic, close to this spot, 80 years ago. Fred Pink leans back, like a man who's proved a point. His belief is unshakable and appalling. I choose my words with care. How did the Greyers achieve what you're saying they achieved? A quartet of psychosoteric breakthroughs. First off, they perfected the lacuna. Which is what? A lacuna's a small space that's immune to time. So a candle will never burn down in it, or a body won't age in it. Second, they enhanced the transversion their Saeed had taught them, what the New Age jokers call astral projection, so they could venture out from their bodies as far as they wanted, for as long as they wanted. Third, they mastered long-term suasioning, so their souls could move into a stranger and occupy that body. Meaning the Greyers were now free to leave their bodies in the lacuna they created in the attic of Slade House and inhabit bodies in the outside world. You with me so far, yes?
Yes, Fred Pink is barking mad. Assuming souls are real.
Souls are as real as gallbladders, Miss Timms, believe me.
And nobody's ever held a soul, or x-rayed one, because...
Is a mind x-rayable? Is hunger? Is jealousy? Time?
I see. So... souls can fly about the place, like Tinkerbell. A pipe gurgles in the wall.
Provided the soul in question is the soul of an engifted.
A what?
An engifted. A psychic, or a potential psychic. And like Tinkerbell, sort of. But a Tinkerbell who will live inside your mind without your consent, for years if it wants, hack into your brain, control your actions, and play funny buggers with your memories. Or kill you.
My phone's vibrating again. So the Greyer twins are a pair of wandering Jews hitching rides in hoths while their own bodies stay dry frozen in a bubble back in Slade House where it's forever 1931. Fred Pink knocks back his brandy.
1934. It took them a few years. And a few lab rats,
to perfect their modus operandi, so to speak. But there's a catch. This system won't run off the mains. It runs off psycho voltage. The psycho voltage of ingifteds.